Today's episode of A Cast of Kings is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audible.com/acastofkings for your free audiobook download. That's audible.com/acastofkings. And for a limited time only, until November 4th, the book Lock and Key is available for free at audible.com/LK. That's audible.com/LANDK. Hello, everyone, and welcome to A Cast of Kings, an unofficial podcast about the HBO original series Game of Thrones. I'm David Chen.
And I'm Joanna Robinson.
And together we're both reading A Game of Thrones from George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. We're reading the first book together and rewatching the first season of the HBO show. You can find more episodes of this podcast at GameofThronesPodcast.com. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. Find us also on Facebook at facebook.com/acastofkings. And today we are going to be discussing everything through season one, episode three of the show entitled Lord Snow. That also means that we're going to be discussing everything in the book through Bran chapter four, the fourth Bran chapter. And we will also be spoiling anything that was on the show, Game of Thrones, the HBO show, through season five. So you should assume that this is for show watchers who are trying to start reading the books from the beginning. That's a very specific category of person, but that's who we're catering to. So there will be no spoilers from anything future in the show that hasn't happened yet. But there will be spoilers through everything that happened in the show. So let's get to it then, shall we, John Robinson? This episode is season one, episode three, Lord Snow. It's directed by Brian Kirk and written by Benioff and Weiss. And you pointed out while we were prepping for this episode that they thus far have writing credits on every single episode, right?
Yeah. So I don't know at what point we'll see any other writers or if they wrote the whole first season. I guess we'll find out. There's no way I can find out right now. We'll find out on a week by week basis.
Yes.
Don't write in, listeners. No, you can write in and tell us.
I'm on the edge of my seat waiting to find out if Weiss and Benioff are going to write every episode of the season.
No, but you know, usually by this point we will have seen, like, you know, our man Brian Cogman or that guy you like who invented Ollie, you know, whatever.
Yeah, he's awesome. So this episode begins with Ned arriving at King's Landing.
Yes.
And he goes straight into a small council meeting. And you point out here in the show notes that there is a distinct change from the book that is actually, I would say, important to Ned's character. In the show, they say, hey, of course, you'll want to change before you go to the small council.
Right.
And Ned just kind of gives this exasperated look as though it would be ridiculous to suggest that they stand on ceremony in such a situation. Whereas in the book, I believe he actually is worried about that, right?
Yeah, I don't know if they talk how much he's worried about it, but he does change his clothes. They're like, you should change your clothes. He's like, oh, yes, okay.
Of course. Why wouldn't I change my clothes?
But I liked that character moment for Ned where he's like, why are you talking to me about this? What are you even talking about?
Yeah, this is a situation where it's literally, you know, a moment, right, in the show. But I would argue that the show actually, quote unquote, gets Ned better than the book does in that instance.
In that moment, yeah.
Which is weird to say, seeing as how the character came from the book.
Right. And it really sets up well the sort of the next scene, the small council scene that follows later. Just the fish out of water-ness of Ned right off the bat. You're wearing the wrong clothes. And he's just like, so? I don't get it. Yeah.
Yeah, really, really good decision there. So then we see the throne room and Ned and Jaime have an encounter.
Yes.
Where they talk about, you know, part of this is kind of expository. It's trying to fill in all these details about why is Jaime called the Kingslayer? You know, what's Ned's opinion on that? All that kind of stuff, right? And what's interesting is later on in the show, we hear the whole backstory about the Kingslayer, right? And why Jaime decided to do what he did and how when you have a king who has gone insane and is torturing and murdering people, actually maybe killing that king is not such a terrible idea. But in at this point in the show, all we've seen of Jaime is that he's pushed Bran off of a tower, he's having sex with his sister, and now we know that he's killed this king in a rather ignominious fashion, right? So I feel like the way the show is framing it at this point is to make Jaime look as bad as possible. What are your thoughts on the scene?
Well, yes, and you know, I think I like the way that it plays with our perceptions, because we think that Ned is our hero and he's always right, and we think that Jaime is someone who pushes kids out of towers and therefore is always wrong. And I think, as the camera moves back, you know, over the course of the series from this scene, we see that it's more nuanced than that. That Ned is actually kind of wrong in how affronted he is about the death of the Mad King Aerys, and that Jaime is kind of right here. Also, Jaime comes a long way from the character we meet in this episode. But I just like that it sets up our expectations. But Jaime has good buttons on this scene, and then later he talks about it again later in the episode, where he just like drops a nugget about what King Aerys was doing when he killed him, and he's like, "You guys, he was crazy. What are you even talking about? Come on."
So. Well, I think it sort of speaks to Ned's character too in this scene about how you get the feeling that Ned would have still followed the king. You know, that's kind of the feeling I got watching it. Is that sure the king was telling people to burn all the citizens, but Ned still would have been honorable and obeyed the king?
No, well, that's not right. I mean, because okay. Ned was part of the rebellion to unseat the king. I think he's more referring to the fact that Jaime was part of the king's guard, you know, so he was like Aerys' bodyguard. So it was like the way that Jaime did it, that he, I think, stabbed him in the back, literally, and was sworn to protect him when he did it. Whereas if Robert and Ned had like ridden into the throne room and, I don't know, captured Aerys and imprisoned him for the rest of his life, or exiled him, or what have you, you know, they would have done, or beheaded him at the Septon of Baelor. Like, they would have done it just differently. It was just the way that Jaime did it.
So just the way it was shameful. I guess what I'm saying is if Ned was in the King's Guard, he would have. Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yes, yes.
Like, if Ned was in Jaime's position. But yes, I see what you're saying, that, you know, Ned wasn't a huge fan of the Mad King either. It's just that the way Jaime did it wasn't what he did. It was the way he did it.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? And did you get the whole, like, how Ned's family died?
That's mentioned. Jaime mentions it, right? So can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Well, yeah, just that, you know, that the Mad King was burning Ned's father alive in his in his armor, cooked alive in his own armor, and then Ned's brother, his older brother who was supposed to marry Catelyn, was there, and he had like a rope tied around his neck, and was just out of reach of his father. So if he like tried to help his father, he was choking himself to death. So he strangled himself trying to get his sword to save his father. And what's interesting is in the original trailer, you can find this online somewhere, but in the original trailer for Game of Thrones, you can see that scene. You can see Brandon Stark choking himself as he's trying to reach his father. It's a guy who looks a lot like Sean Bean, but is not Sean Bean. And it's really brief. It's like a couple seconds, but it was in there. And so it's evidence that originally they did consider putting flashbacks in before, you know, famously they broke the flashback seal this last season.
Right.
But it's evidence that they shot the footage and were considering doing flashbacks early on.
So. Which I don't think was a bad move at all. I mean, the thing is, most of the first season, or not most, but a huge chunk of it is people sitting around in throne rooms or rooms talking about stuff that happened in the past.
Yeah, basically. It's true. It's right? A lot of exposition.
Huge amount of the show is that. And so it would not surprise me if during the writing process they thought to themselves, hey, this is too much exposition. We must figure out a way to make this more visually engaging. And so let's shoot flashback sequences. But how do you feel about the lack of flashbacks? Do you feel like it would have added something if we'd had some kind of voiceover narration with Jamie describing it, and then cut to you see the actual thing that they're describing happening on screen. What do you think?
I mean, the way you put it sounds like so unbelievably cheesy, and I feel like they maybe cut it together and they were like, oh god, no, this looks like
it's way more
Xena
effective, yeah,
or something.
Right.
I think the way, at least so far, these first three episodes, I've really enjoyed the way that they work character building into the exposition. Like, I think, you know, we'll get more from like Littlefinger this episode and stuff like that. Like, I think we really get to know the characters while they're telling this saga of how we got here. And maybe that just became more challenging as the show went on. I mean, they used the flashback this last season with Cersei. It was a very light touch. It was very, very minimal. And it wasn't even like her telling a story. You just see it happen and then you see her face knowing that she's remembering it. You know, it wasn't some cheesy, I remember when I was a girl, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, so I think they're wise to use it sparingly.
I think it is odd that they use it at all. I remember we did this Breaking Bad podcast, The Ones Who Knock, and I remember there was a scene in that show that took place in Texas, right? Whereas the rest of the show set in Albuquerque. And I was listening to the podcast of Breaking Bad, the Vince Gilligan podcast, where they kind of go behind the scenes, and how they wanted a way to denote that they were cutting to Texas. And they were thinking of putting text on the screen to say, hey, this is Texas. But they had never done that for the entirety of the series.
Right.
And so to start doing it, you know, five seasons in would have been weird. It is just odd to me that they, like, I think the Cersei scene that they chose for flashback this season was very good, well executed, as with most things Game of Thrones.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know that it was worth breaking the rule for. Do you know what I mean? Like, that they set up this rule where no flashbacks, and then, to my knowledge, that is the only flashback they've ever done.
Right.
You know? It's not like they're doing it sparingly. When you say sparingly, you mean once, right?
Yes.
I would understand if it was, once a season or two times a season. You know what I mean? I just feel like they did it once, and I'm not sure that it warranted breaking the rule for. I'm not. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'm kind of torn about it. That's all I'm saying. But I agree that, like you said, they're using the exposition as a way of building character. Having Ned and Jamie have this conversation is different than just say like having Ned do a monologue or thinking to himself about it, right?
Right,
because
right.
They're having the conversation, you learn a lot about their relationship and the tension between them. So,
and Nicola Costa-Waldau is just so good, like right off the bat. I mean, I think he really got a chance to deepen that character. And Jamie was just so wasted this last season, and it's so fun to see him, you know, this great actor just doing fine work, you know?
Definitely. So then Ned goes to the small council.
Yeah.
And we meet all these people, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we meet Maester Pycelle, we meet Littlefinger, we meet Varys and Renly.
In the book, it's Stannis and someone else. They're absent, like, because there's more people in the small council.
Right. So they have a conversation. I think the main things that we learn from this scene are they want to have a tournament to celebrate Ned, getting the job
right
for him, and the crown is dramatically in debt.
Right.
Yeah.
And in the show version, they just frame it in terms of the Lannisters, like the crown is in debt to the Lannisters. But in the book, they do mention the Iron Bank of Braavos. Then, like, that's how soon they start seeding in the Iron Bank of Braavos, which they didn't do, I think, until season four in the show. So.
Yeah, maybe they didn't know if they'd make it to season four, right? Or they didn't know if
I think it complicates it unnecessarily.
Right.
I think if you just set up like the Lannisters versus the Starks, you know, or the Lannisters versus the Brat, you know, exactly. It's cleaner.
I just want to point something out, and maybe I'm insane. This is this point I'm about to bring up is like you with the wigs. John Robinson, it's a thing that I have not heard anyone complain about except you. But
the wigs?
Yeah, but maybe I just don't read enough.
Read enough wig forums.
Exactly.
People hate the wigs from season one.
I'm not in the wig forums as much as I should. Here is my observation about the scene and how Game of Thrones changed over time. Littlefinger sounds like a human being in season one. Oh, it doesn't sound like
or his accent got all weird.
He doesn't sound like he's ADR'd to hell. I mean, it sounds like he's doing a Batman impression of himself in later seasons, right? He sounds like a normal person in this scene. Like, I could see this person, this actor, in a room recording these. Aidan Gillen, right?
Yeah.
I could see him in a room recording these lines, and the sound matches with his what he's saying. And then in later seasons, it sounds like either the ADR is bad, or the sound is bad, or he's doing something weird. But you know, he went from sounding like a normal person to he's doing like a chaos is a ladder. You know, it just sounds like a much weirder version of his voice.
My brother instructs us to stage a tournament in honor of Lord Stark's appointment as Hand of the King.
How much?
40,000 gold dragons to the champion. 20,000 to the runner-up, 20,000 to the winning archer.
Can the treasury bear such expense?
I'll have to borrow it. The Lannisters will accommodate, I expect. We already owe Lord Tywin 3 million gold. What's another 80,000?
Are you telling me the crown is 3 million in debt?
I'm telling you the crown is 6 million in debt.
How could he let this happen?
The Master of Coin finds the money. The king and the hand spend it.
I will not believe John Arryn allowed Robert to bankrupt the realm.
Lord Arryn gave wise and prudent advice, but I fear his grace doesn't always listen.
Counting coppers, he calls it.
I'll speak to him tomorrow. This tournament is an extravagance we cannot afford.
As you will, but still, we'd best make our plans.
There will be no plans until I speak to Robert.
Well, I mean, I wonder if that's a little bit intentional, because when we first meet Littlefinger, we're not supposed to know what a manipulative bastard he is. And I wonder if now Aidan Gillen just feels like licensed to twirl his mustache in every single scene if he wants to.
Well, that is a very charitable reading of this issue. But yeah. Anyway, going back to the scene, I'll try not to bring that up again. Is this something that you have recognized, or is it just my imagination?
No, you're right. You're right that he's much more toned down here than he is later.
His voice, just when he opened his mouth and spoke, I was like, wow, I forgot what Aidan Gillen's voice sounds like normal. You know. Anyway, pretty interesting.
I'm just always relieved when he's not trying to do a Baltimore accent. Perfect.
Yes. I agree completely. That was painful to listen to for many, many episodes. the other thing just to point out is that Ned clearly is not super into, you know, statecraft, right? It doesn't seem like this is the type of thing that he really wanted to get into.
Oh yeah, not at all. He thinks it's nonsense, like especially like the tourney business. Yeah. He's so like, why would we have a tournament if we're in debt? It doesn't make any sense. Why didn't John Arryn keep Robert in check? You know, and I just feel like there's so much of the scene with like Varys and Renly and Littlefinger, and to a lesser degree Pycelle, like just blinking at Ned, being like, you do not get this at all. Man, you're screwed. Like, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Totally.
And I mean, it's so interesting to see that small council and to think about like we talked about this, I think, actually last season, trying to remember all the people who had been on the small council over the various seasons.
Right.
But I mean, this is a dream team, right? Littlefinger, Varys, Renly, Pycelle, Stannis, though he's absent, and one more person I keep forgetting. You know, like that's a strong small council, right?
Yeah.
I would want both Varys and Littlefinger on my small council. I don't know.
Totally. Tom Tucker wrote this comment at facebook.com/acastofkings, which is where you can write comments. You can also email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. You made a point last episode, Joanna, or a couple episodes ago, about how in the season premiere of the show, Cersei says, man, we've been traveling for a month to get to Winterfell from King's Landing. And Tom Tucker writes in, I think you're missing a point on the travel times. It takes a month for the 1,000-person royal court to get from King's Landing to Winterfell, but a small group or a lone rider could do it much faster. A single rider can get a fresh horse at each inn and make really good time if needed. So the Littlefinger Express really does exist, even if it does have a very limited capacity. So what'd you think of Tom Tucker's point about travel times between the locations?
I told you off air. I'll say it to Tom Tucker's face. I think it's halfway to a good point. That is a good point. Of course, yes, it will take an entourage, the queen with all her retinue, like a long time to get somewhere. I still think they have elided the travel time a lot in season 5 for convenience. And I mean, it's not just with Littlefinger and his ridiculously zooming around the kingdoms. It's Melisandre also got back to the wall within like, I don't know, an afternoon.
Yeah. She went from Winterfell to the wall, yeah, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, I just think they're being a little careless with that, but your larger point, Tom Tucker, does stand. Yes.
Indeed. Well, thanks for writing that in at facebook.com/acastofkings. So let's also just talk briefly about the other King's Landing scenes, except for, let's go through all the King's Landing scenes. Except for the final one. We'll save that for the end. But okay. So we have a sort of confrontation between Arya and Sansa. They're still really not happy with each other. And because of what happened at the King's Road last week. And Ned has a really nice heart-to-heart with Arya, right?
Yeah.
And you get a really good sense of the relationship between the two of them, you know?
In so little time, yeah. You know? I'm impressed by how much family bonding and building they do. Like, think about how little screen time Maisie Williams actually got with Sean Bean, you know?
Look at me. You're a Stark of Winterfell. You know our words.
Winter's coming.
You were born in the long summer. You've never known anything else. But now winter is truly coming. And in the winter, we must protect ourselves. Look after one another. Sansa is your sister.
I don't hate her. Not really.
I don't want to frighten you. But I won't lie to you either. We've come to a dangerous place. We cannot fight a war amongst ourselves.
And that scene made me tear up when I rewatched it.
Because you knew of his impending doom?
No, but also just he's so lovely. Like, and Maisie's so good in that scene. And just Sean Bean, watching Sean Bean be a father, it's just, I'm getting like teary-eyed just thinking about it.
He also kind of defended Sansa in that situation. I mean, he kind of believes Arya, and he's defending Sansa. He's saying, hey, you know what? Sansa can't just throw Joffrey under the bus. She's going to be married to him one day, right? And so I think he kind of, even though later on he might not fully understand how to play the Game of Thrones, he does express some understanding of these dynamics in this scene. So
yeah, there's a line from the book that did make it, like, the essence of it made it into the scene, but there's a line from the book that when the lone wolf dies, the pack survives. You know, he talks a lot about how the Starks are in dangerous territory. Not only is winter's coming and all of that like they talk about throughout the episode, but like that these small pack of Starks, which is Arya, Sansa, and Ned, are all they have, and they're in this strange world. You know, they've got Jory, but like not much more, and they're in this hostile territory, and they have to stick together and be a wolf pack, you know. And it contrasts with this other scene that we get with, forgive me for hopping to another scene, but like with Cersei and Joffrey, where Cersei basically says the same thing to Joffrey, you know, everyone who isn't us is an enemy. Like, we are the Lannisters, we stick together. I mean, technically they're Baratheons, but we're Lannisters, we stick together. You know, they're really nice mirror scenes. And, you know, the Cersei Joffrey stuff is not in the book. This is a show invention, but it's a really nice setting up the duality of these two families.
Yeah, really well written, that Cersei Joffrey scene, I found.
Yes, yes.
And this idea of the truth is what you make of it, and you can have sex with whoever you want. We really get a good sense of this mothering talent that Cersei has.
If you want to have sex with painted whores, you will have sex with painted whores. but also they, like, as we talked about before, they shoehorn in some like exposition where she talks about the North, how big the North is, how hard it is to hold, why you need to make nice with the Northerners if you're King's Landing, because you can't conquer it. You need them as allies. And that's why we need to be pleasant to the Starks for now.
Right. So really great well done exposition, I have to say. I mean, just really effective. And, you know, I'm not going to keep making this observation, but I will just say once more that, you know, the scene with Ned and Arya in the books just goes on for pages and pages and pages, and they just slim it down to its barest essentials, right? I really just love the economy with which they do it in the show. I also want to point out that as we're recording this in early October, have you been seeing this viral video that's been going around the internet of this kid who wanted jalapeno mac and cheese at the University of Connecticut?
Yeah, the Joffrey of University of Connecticut.
If Joffrey was alive today, it's difficult for me to imagine he would be that much different than this UConn kid.
He would be losing his like Adidas sandals.
He would wear Adidas sandals with socks.
Like a monster.
Which would be the worst part. He would get dry. But on a serious level, none of this is serious. But I will say that you sense the fact. So what is this kid's name? I'm trying to find it right now.
Patrick something? No.
Why aren't these publications naming him? Luke Gotti.
Oh.
Luke Gotti, which...
He's put it out there.
I mean, when you think of a person named Luke Gotti, you think that's probably someone who would do something like this. Sorry, all the Luke Gottis listening to this out there.
I mean, the thing is, the site that I read it on like went into some of his... Like, he's been arrested and expelled a couple times before, right. I think. So this isn't like... You know, he's young. He's clearly intoxicated. I mean, he looks like a monumental asshole.
It is crazy. It is crazy how this is an international news story because of this. You know, so some unknown person shot this video for 10 minutes. But I mean, I watched the entire thing multiple times. Deadspin, USA Today is writing about this. New York Daily News,
Slow Newsweek.
Point.
But then who would be the like the noble, you know, cafeteria worker? That's giving it a devotion.
Clearly, that is Ned.
That's Ned Stark. Ned Stark of the Commons. I don't remember what it was called. But, and he's got his like loyal bannermen. Like he's got
his
employees who are just like
attacked him. Right. That's right. This is a perfect analogy. But it's the point I was making is that Luke Gotti is when you watch him behave like this, it is incredibly likely that his parents gave him a speech that was like this. Either they were completely disengaged and therefore let him do whatever the hell he wants.
The Cersei speech.
Right.
Oh yeah.
Okay. Whatever you want, you shall have, you know?
If you want jalapeno mac and cheese, you shall have jalapeno mac and cheese.
No matter what.
You are my beautiful boy, and you get what you want.
No one will tell you no when it comes to the jalapeno mac and cheese. We'll link to this video in the show notes if you haven't seen it yet. But and it is worth watching all the way to the end. But yeah, it does strike me that we do have one of the many things Game of Thrones excels at is at showing us the results of good and bad parenting.
Yeah.
And we were able to see that for ourselves on the internet this week. So, anyway. All right, anything else about King's Landing other than Ciro Forel?
Well, the Catelyn stuff? Does that count?
Oh, yeah, I guess so. So, there's a quick scene in Winterfell with Bran. Where he tells old Nan, hey, tell me the real stories. And the old Nan freaking goes nuts. And
that's because Bran is the worst to her. He's like, he's kind of a little Luke Gotti in that moment. I mean, we can sip of that. But he's like, I hate you. I hate your stories. You're the worst. And she's like, oh, you want a scary story, little boy? I will tell you one. It involves White Walkers and ice spiders as big as hounds. And it's scary. Yeah.
It's pretty good. It's pretty good. And then we learned that Bran will probably never walk again. And Bran says, I'd rather be dead. And I think one of the things that we talked about last week was how in the books, it's much more clear kind of how important the whole walking around is and the climbing stuff is for Bran. I think the show does get at that a little bit. with him practicing archery in the opening scene. And, you know, we get the sense that he wants to be a fighter, you know, wants to be a Stark. But I feel like the impact of him losing his ability to walk is more felt in the books. What do you think?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we do have Richard Madden, Rob Stark in this scene, you know, reiterating, I've seen you climb 100 times, you never fall, you know, so like, right, kind of reiterating Bran's, you know, love
his
of climbing.
Proclivity for, yes, climbing, right? Yes. But yeah, we don't understand how important it is as part of his identity as much as we do in the books.
And I think Isaac Hempstead White was really good in this scene, but I also think Richard Madden was really good in this scene. I forgot how much I like him in this show.
You could just get lost in his eyes.
I mean, they are the dreamiest.
Indeed. So anything else about that scene, or shall we get to the cat stuff?
Let's move along, I think.
So Cat and Sir Roderick ride into King's Landing, and Littlefinger summons for them. In the book, I don't think she – it's I don't think she's staying at his brothel, right? She's staying at some inn, if I recall correctly.
No, she's staying in an inn, but he summons her to the brothel.
Right,
yeah.
Right. Whereas I guess they just cut that whole part out in this.
The inn part, yes.
They made it simpler, and she's just going straight to the brothel.
Right.
And then there's all this exposition about, hey, the dagger, and Varys is there, and he's saying he knows everything that happened, and Littlefinger identifies the dagger as belonging to him, and then ceded to Tyrion at some point during a tournament, right?
Right.
And so Catelyn is then convinced that Tyrion's the one's responsible for,
right,
for Bran's potential assassination. So, and then Ned arrives.
Yeah, there is a quick scene with Ned and Pycelle before Littlefinger, like, you know, draws Ned to the brothel. But it just reminded me that Pycelle, we have this scene towards the end of the season where Pycelle, it's made clear that Pycelle is like pretending to be as aged as he is, right?
Right.
They also mentioned how long he's been around because he served the Mad King Aerys, but I think maybe even before that as well. But yeah, just Julian Glover shuffling into the throne room like so slowly, and Ned looking kind of impatient, like, what are you doing? The Pycelle stuff like still hasn't quite like borne out for me, but I mean, the man is still there. He's kind of like the cockroach of King's Landing.
What do you mean, right? It hasn't borne out for you?
Well, like, there was that whole reveal of like, oh, Pycelle's putting on his like old man act, but like, I have yet to see like really, you know, Pycelle is yet to wow me the way that like Littlefinger or Varys can, you know, except I guess just by his durability that he like, you know, that he's still there.
Well, here's what I would say about that. The fact that he's just pretending, I mean, I think that's just one element of his character. I don't think it was, hey, we're showing you that he's kind of pretending so that there's going to be some big reveal at some point.
No, I wasn't expecting him to, like, get a lightsaber out and go, like, you know, jump around like Yoda or something like that. But right. I was just like, I wasn't expecting some big physical reveal. I just, I don't know.
I did think the way that season two, which is a season we'd much rather forget, made great use of him, if I recall. Right? Where.
He was a good foil for Tyrion. When Tyrion was, like, taking people down,
exactly,
Pycelle was a good target.
And for me, that kind of made the whole thing worth it. Because, like, we're already inclined to dislike this character. At least we are starting season one. And so then when he gets his comeuppance, it feels more satisfying.
Yeah. But now Tyrion's in exile and Pycelle's back on top. So you always bet on Pycelle, I think.
Always bet on Pycelle. Right. Good philosophy. So. Littlefinger brings Ned to the brothel, and it's actually a very funny moment when Ned's like, oh, you think you're funny, you know, because he's bringing him to the brothel. So Littlefinger's making a joke. He's hilarious. This quick temper, slow minds felt like a line that came from the book. Did it? I don't recall reading it there.
Yeah, I don't think it was in the books, but there is a video that someone made back in 2012 called Game of Thrones as a Seinfeld sitcom.
Uh-huh.
And this is episode one, where basically they like put a laugh track, like when Catelyn pops her head out,
right?
You know, which just looks very cartoonish. There's a laugh track,
yeah.
And then it ends with a button of you know, Littlefinger being like, "Stucks, quick temper, slow minds," you know, and then like a laugh track. I mean, it doesn't quite work, but it is like once I saw that and then rewatched the scene, I heard the laugh track because right. I was just like, "This is a weirdly comedic scene."
It is very book-like, I thought. For them to do that. Anyway, so they have this conversation where all the stuff is conveyed, and they're saying, you know, I think, okay, look, you know, I am not into the MRA movement, John Robinson.
What?
I know, you're like, why are you bringing that up? there's some controversy around the term friend zone, right? And whether that's a healthy term to use.
Uh-huh.
So I don't mean to, you know, wade into that debate. But I will say that when Kat said to Ned, he's like a brother to me. He's like my little brother. I felt like, oh my gosh, Littlefinger just got friend-zoned so hard in that scene.
I was surprised he didn't do like a physical wince, like a really hard.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was like, ooh, that's rough. You know, he fought a duel, like because he wanted to marry you, right?
You know, he has like a huge, massive scar.
Yeah, because he fought a duel. Like, you don't call him your little brother. That's rough stuff, Catelyn.
Indeed.
And then later, too, Ned's like, he's still in love with you, and Catelyn's like, oh, is he? And I'm just like, Cat, it's very sensitive.
Yeah.
I mean, be nice to Littlefinger is the lesson I think we've learned after.
Not even be nice. Seasons. Just be not even be nice. Be sensitive to his feelings.
Yeah.
You know? I wonder if they had been, if things would have played out differently.
Yeah. Well, I think there have definitely been plenty of people who like to trace this whole thing back to Kat. Like to blame the whole thing on Kat. So we can add this to the list.
I will say that looking back on the show, right? Rewatching the first season, I had a great deal of respect for the Catelyn Stark character, simply because I love the performance, and I felt like at every step of the way, I understood her actions. You know, I understood why she's doing what she's doing. She's just a concerned mom, you know, and we can all relate with concerned mom because many of us have concerned moms. But rewatching the show, I do feel like this character is a bit useless, just because. She doesn't really accomplish anything. You know what I mean? She leaves and then it feels like she does a lot of stupid things through the course of the years.
Yeah, she's a little hasty, I think, in some aspects. I mean, I think the problem with Kat, the reason we're like never going to be on her team is because she's such an asshole to Jon Snow. Like, it's easier to be Team Kat if she weren't such an asshole to this little boy who did nothing wrong himself, you know?
Okay. I don't know if that's my reason for not liking her as a character.
Trust me. No. But yeah, no, you're right. I mean, we'll get it. We can revisit this theme throughout the season where, you know, her encounters Tyrion and then
right.
You know, other stuff. So,
and then, I guess when I was watching, I was like, man, what a great. You know, quote unquote strong female character, which is a term I freaking hate.
It's like the friend zone of characters.
It's like the friend zone of character. Yeah, well, you know, what a great character. Not great strong female character, just great character. First time I watched it, I thought this is great. But then the second time, now watching it again, I'm like, did she really do that much? You know?
There is, you know, something to be said for a female character who's allowed to be not wholly likable. And so, you know, which can be, you know, a plague sometimes to female characters. They have to be likable. I think it's kind of, you know, at least a little more interesting that Catelyn has this quite a few flaws. Yeah. Anyway.
Yeah.
We'll keep on holding Kat accountable for her shitty decision.
Well, before we move on, let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
Let me ask you a question, Jenna Robbins. Here's a quiz.
Riddle me this. Yes.
Riddle you this. So you read a lot of books, right, Jenna?
I sure do.
And how many books do you think you read in a given year?
I don't know. Let's say 48. I'm going to try to average one a week. That's 52. 52.
It's pretty impressive. Maybe wow, that's actually staggering. I'm really impressed. Here's a question. Do you think that listening to a book is the same, or if you listen to a book, does that count as reading it?
My mom used to call it reading it with her ears.
Reading it with your ears. Exactly. Yeah.
I like audiobooks a lot. Is that your question?
That is a question. And in fact, you know, I have a feeling if you're listening to Cast of Kings, you would also like audiobooks. I mean,
yeah, you like the feel of headphones on your head, right?
You like headphones on your head. You like people talking at you through your ear holes. And so fortunately, we have just a deal for you. If you go to audible.com/acastofkings, that's audible.com/acastofkings. Sign up for an account. You get a free audiobook download. That's audible.com/acastofkings. Audible, for those who don't know, is one of the finest purveyors of audio products on the internet. They have over 180,000 audio programs from leading audiobook publishers, broadcasters, entertainers, and magazine and newspaper publishers. And what you do is you sign up for an Audible account, get the app for iPhone, Android, Windows Phone, and you can listen to any audiobook you download on any of those platforms. And I have a very robust Audible library. I actually went a little bit crazy, you know, not too many months ago, and downloaded a ton of Audible books. And you know, I've been working my way through them because it is really convenient to listen to books, and you get the same sense of accomplishment as you do when you read them. And so that's really awesome. I guess let's, for this first Audible ad, let's just recommend the Audible book for Game of Thrones, right? And this is a really solid audio book because it is read in a British accent. And we all know how important British accents are for Game of Thrones, right?
Yes, it's read by Roy Dotrice.
Right, and he does a great job. I've heard his reading of this book, and it's very engaging. And it is fascinating. You know, there's I don't remember what it was, the New York Times, I think, about how why these sword and sandals, medieval things are always in English accents, right? Mm-hmm. Do you think that Game of Thrones would be as effective if it was with American accents?
No, I don't think so. No.
I think it would be too weird. Do you know?
We don't have any American actors, right, on the show?
I don't know about that. But isn't Peter Dinklage American?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah. And I think his accent is kind of...
Yeah, it's pretty shaky.
But, of course, Peter Dinklage, yeah. I think it is much better. And also, when you watch Star Wars, you know, most of Star Wars, that's not true. The bad guys in Star Wars have British accents. And they sound better than dumb Luke, who's just like, oh, I want to go to Tosche Station, pick up some power converters.
Exactly.
So, you know,
British accents gives this kind of otherness.
At least
it.
Carrie Fisher's trying to do a British accent, you know.
it gives it an otherness, which in this case kind of translates to an otherworldliness that I think is quite effective. And so you can get that book for free right now by going to audible.com/acastofkings. And you get a free audiobook, and you sign up for an account. I think you pay a certain amount each month, and you get a free credit and a bunch of other benefits, too, with an Audible membership. And no matter what happens, if you cancel it or whatever, you still get to keep the audiobooks that you get. So it's a pretty great deal, and we're really grateful to Audible for sponsoring us. So we'd urge you to go to audible.com/acastofkings and get your free audiobook today. So thanks to them for sponsoring us. Let's move on with the show, Joanna Robinson. So a few other things, a few of the plot lines we haven't covered. Number one is the wall, right? And this sequence at the wall is where the episode gets its title. And I will confess to you that it is not something I fully understood my first time watching the show. Basically, this whole rewatch is about me explaining how dumb I was when I first started watching the show. People thought I was dumb, you know, when I'm watching later seasons. It was way worse for the first season. But I guess, again, at this point in the series, my brain was still struggling to grasp kind of the who is where and what's going on and what are these places' relationships to each other.
Of course.
So the idea that they're calling him Lord Snow as a pejorative term did not register with me. I didn't understand.
Of course, it's Alistair Thorne.
Of course. Of course, but
that monumental dick. Sorry.
I guess the idea is that Winterfell and the Wall, to me, they're all kind of cold medieval places. I didn't think of Winterfell as, oh, this is the manor. This is the place where hoity-toity Starks live, and the Wall is this wasteland. You know what I mean? Like that kind of difference didn't really land with me the first time I watched it. Now, of course, you realize that. Jon Snow's life was probably way easier and better than many of his fellow recruits.
Oh, yeah.
For sure. So, and Tyrion, I feel like, is integrated into a lot more of these scenes than he was in the book.
Yeah, they cut out a character named Donald Noy, who is like this one-armed blacksmith that's in the books. And he features a lot. He's like a – he's in the Battle of Castle Black, late in the books. Like, he's kind of a – I don't know if you want to say important. Whatever. He's a character that I miss from the show. And they basically gave most of his stuff to Tyrion in the episode, where Tyrion's the one who like breaks up the fight between Gren and Pip and Jon, and is like, hey, listen, these are the sad backstories on Gren and Pip. Like, maybe give them a break and be nicer to them.
Right. So I think it's a good effect, right? I like what the show is overall doing. It's taking characters like Tyrion and Gene Poole, who is also mentioned in this this week's reading, right? who is not even in the show at all, right?
Right.
And it just gives that stuff to other characters.
Yeah.
Which sometimes for better, sometimes for worse, right, John Robinson?
Right.
So in this case, I think it's cool. We get to learn more. All the stuff that happens with Tyrion is kind of in fitting with his character.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And I think one of the big differences in the book and the show is in the show, there's a confrontation with Mormont and Aegon and Tyrion, where they're saying, hey, please help us. We are dying out here.
Yeah.
And in the book, I think Tyrion makes it clear, there's no way I'm going to do anything to help you at all. Right.
Right. And here he looks like he's softening a little bit.
Here it looks like it's possible. Like, this might actually become a significant plot point in the show, which it never does because he can't do anything. So,
when he does go back to King's Landing, I think he does try to mention the Wall a few times.
Oh, yes. He tries to mention it a few times.
No, I mean, like, I think this is where we see Tyrion get a wider understanding of the world that the rest of the Lannisters don't have at this point. He's still sort of considering all the tall tales from the north to be, fairy tales, but, Commander Mormont and Aemon do point out, how few men they have, how ragged they are, and how if something were to happen, they are the line. They are holding the line, and they're suffering. And I think it's important that Tyrion get that education.
Right. No, that's fair enough. I guess from my mind, I'm very literal or very kind of focused on plot mechanics, so I was always wondering, is Tyrion going to try and get the money? Is that going to become a plot point? It never does. And the book kind of puts that to bed pretty quickly, whereas the show, I think, leaves it a little more open.
Or it hasn't yet.
Good point.
I don't know.
I do think also the book does a better job of kind of conveying the extent of Castle Black's operations. You know what I mean?
Right, the multiple castles.
The multiple castles, and you get a better sense of, what is actually going on.
Right.
Whereas in the show, even through several seasons, it was always ambiguous to me. Wait, so is it just one does the castle span the whole wall? I just didn't even understand how the mechanics of that even worked.
Right, and I feel like you asked me last season or maybe two seasons ago when they were doing the Battle for Castle Black, like, how many people are at the wall?
Right.
And I was like, duh, I don't know. But
in that voice, I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But here, both in the show and the book, they say it was 1,000 people, right?
Yes, that's right. Which is
1,000, and they said 600 at Castle Black and then 200 spread over the other, or several outranging and, Anyway, get the answers to those questions you had 2 years ago, maybe.
Well, thanks. It's all
better
coming full
late than never.
It's all coming full circle. What else happens in this? Tyrion says Pip was stealing food for his sister. right? But later, I feel like later on, don't we find out that Pip, his master actually made a pass at him? Is that right? Am I remembering that correctly?
Oh, I don't know.
All right, let's come back to that. I believe that is correct, though. So maybe Tyrion that was the official story, right? But Pip, there was actually a different story for Pip.
It's a cover-up. It's a cover-up. Yeah. It's fun. I mean, it's fun to see Pip and Gren, who, like, you know, become John's, you know, friends.
Best friends.
Yeah.
Best buds.
To see them, like, bullying him in a stable.
Right.
So, yeah.
Very amusing. So what else happens at Castle Black? Benjen says he's going out. John can't go with him. Right.
And he says, we'll speak when I return.
Yes.
Which is what Ned said, too. So, basically. So, yeah, then we still haven't seen Benjen again. Thanks, Ollie. <No problem.
laughs> So the Ollie Rules subreddit is still alive and well. Okay. As is a Fuck Ollie subreddit. My favorite post from recently was...
You still like check in regularly with the Ollie?
I don't check in regularly. I dip in on occasion. At ollierules.reddit.com and fuckollie.reddit.com. And I think one of my favorite posts recently was Ollie actually thought that the wooden pole was Benjen. And that's why he brought John there. That episode.
Oh my God. Yes.
people don't like Ollie very much. What else happens? Tyrion and Jon say goodbye. We meet the dude who the show introduces the character who is gathering recruits, who then later kind of saves Arya's life.
Yoren,
right?
Didn't he not go north to the Wall with them? Wasn't he on the road with them when they went?
I believe that's correct. Yeah.
Okay. But we get to know him more, and he and Peter Dinklage did have a really great scene.
They did.
Benjen calls Tyrion a plump little lord, and Tyrion's like, do you think I'm plump? Like, yeah.
Anyway. Well, yeah, you really get a good sense of the tension between, like, Tyrion and the Wall here. Why is this kind of rich lord just...
tourist. He's being a tourist.
Yeah, he's just being a tourist.
Yeah.
You know, he doesn't belong here. At the time, I did not understand how important Yoren would be.
Yes.
I will say, you know, I group all these characters into, oh, these are characters whose names I don't really need to know or remember.
Right.
And then, of course, later, he becomes absolutely crucial in the plot.
Yeah.
So interesting how the show kind of seeds in these characters who may come back in a big way later on. Anything else at the Wall?
No.
Yeah, that's about it. And also, We'll Speak When I Return is like, I'll be right back from the Wes Craven Scream movie. yeah. So then
one more case?
Yeah. We got some final scenes at King's Landing.
Yes.
So Robert and Ser Barristan just having a conversation. Is there anything specific that prompts this? They're just chilling, right?
I think it's just Robert being asshole. He's like, let's talk about the first guys we ever killed. Right. That'll be fun for you, Ser Barristan. And Ser Barristan's like, ugh, I used to do noble things and now I have to babysit this drunken baby king. Yeah, it's low times for Ser Barristan, I think.
Really? I did not get that sense at all watching this scene. I thought it was kind of Ser Barristan was kind of taken with the whole gravity of the conversation. That was my take on it.
Oh.
That they're talking about the first people. He's reminiscing with someone who was once a warrior who he admired. Do you know?
Yeah, sure.
I didn't get that at all. But
I mean, especially since you see Robert just like being an utter bastard to Lancel and then also to Jaime, you know. And I guess he's the nicest to Barristan, but it just seemed to me to be like, you know. And I think they kind of make it clear in the book that like after the thing that happened at the Trident with Arya and Joffrey and all of that, you know, Robert sort of doesn't really talk to Ned anymore, like rides ahead and doesn't ride with Ned anymore. And so I think what you see here is Robert sort of feeling crappy about himself that he let Cersei railroad him, that he was like really excited to hang out with his bro Ned again, and he just like ruined it, you know, by making him kill a wolf, you know. And so I think he's just drinking and abusing the people who have to be around him. is how I read it. But
we also learned that Robert's first kill was a Tarly boy.
Yeah.
Which is Samwell Tarly. I think he comes into play first season, right? So.
Yeah, I think we meet Sam next episode.
There you go.
But yeah, from the Tarly family, but it's never specified. I did look this up. I was like, is it a Tarly we should know? But it's not like Sam's older brother or anything like that. The timeline would be wrong anyway. And then to see Lancel with all his
crazy. It is crazy. It's crazy that they introduced this character.
Yeah, yeah.
It's, I mean, was the most recent book featuring Lancel even written at the time that this scene happened? Do you know what I mean? During this first season?
I think Dance with Dragons came out after the first season.
Right. So, and Dance with Dragons, I presume, has all the stuff with Lancel in it? Is that correct?
I think some of it's in... No, it's in Feast for Crows. So okay. It's already out. And I mean, anyway, Lancel, as we've discussed before, Lancel's the one who poisons the king. So the fact that you need to have him here, like, shown, pouring wine down Robert's throat, basically, like that he's the cup boy, so he's in the position to do this. Yeah, so
I just think it's awesome that there is this character that they introduced who then 5 years later also plays a major role
again,
in a big way.
And especially like he just looks so different, you know, like not just floppy wig, he just looks softer and smaller.
And he doesn't have a freaking thing carved in his face as far as I recall, right?
Yeah.
So they bring in Jamie to kind of reminisce as well, and you get a little bit more exposition about how the Mad King was saying burn them all, and you get a sense of how much disdain Jamie and Robert have for each other.
Yeah. Right? But also how much respect Jamie and Barristan have for each other.
Right, right. Anything else to say about the scene? I think this is Game of Thrones season one at its best in the sense that it's just these dudes talking about the past, but still incredibly well acted and very engaging, you know?
Yeah, and character. This also came after this Jaime and Cersei scene where we get, like, you know, well, not quite another Jaime and Cersei sex scene, but we get another, you know, romantic clinch between the two, and this is where Jaime says his famous line about the war for Cersei's cunt. Did you want to read that listener
comment? Yeah, sure. So okay. Dorian Pons writes at facebook.com/thecastofkings. I'm a little disappointed that during your discussion of season one, episode one, no one mentioned the dubious consent between Cersei and Jaime in chapter 8 of Bran's chapter. The past few seasons featured so much discussion of rape in the show compared to the books, but as I'm doing a reread myself, I'm noticing that the consent I thought I saw in the book is a little suspect as well. In the book, as Bran climbs up the tower, he can hear Cersei telling Jaime to stop. She tells him to stop 4 times. It's not something I noticed during the first read, but after what happened in season 4, it seems like even in the books, Jaime often disregarded Cersei's protests. In chapter 8, Jaime is like, be quiet and come here so he can have sex with her, which leads into her chorus of stop. I think it would have been an interesting little discussion to talk about, but sadly, no one even seemed to notice. The two book scenes of Jaime and Cersei having sex both have Cersei saying no or stop at some point. The reread has me convinced that at worst, Jaime raped Cersei in both the book and the show, and at best, their relationship is supposed to have this thin layer of prior consent where she says no but means yes. Both are problems for me, though. I think the latter might be something George R. R. Martin intended to say something sick about Jaime and Cersei's complicated relationship. So let's end quote right there. What do you think of that, Jonah?
I'm not sure I'm up for getting like entirely into that. Not to disappoint people who love when we talk about this, but I will say that you know, I read that comment actually earlier today, and then I watched the episode, and in this scene, you know, Jamie's sort of pawing at Cersei, and she's like, "Stop, no!" Like, yeah, just even in that scene too. So it does seem to be like sort of their standard patter. What that says about consent, I don't know. I mean, like, it's just hard to honestly to nail down where the toxicity begins and ends with Jaime and Cersei. How about you, Dave?
I mean, I don't really know anything I could say that would not get me into trouble. So I will say this. It's clear that their relationship is messed up. How about that?
Yeah.
It's clear that their relationship is messed up.
I think everyone can co-sign that.
Yes. And whether or not, you know, she's actually consenting to be you know, roughed up in that way. I can't speak to that, but I can certainly see why someone might draw that conclusion from even the show, right? So, or not, or draw the opposite conclusion as well. So, anyway.
Either way, you know, once again, it's a good reminder of how far, you know, Jamie in that scene with Cersei is just being the worst version of Jamie, right? You know, he's like, he's a kid, doesn't matter. Oh, then I'll kill him. I don't care. You know, like, it doesn't matter. You and I are the only thing that matters. Everyone else can die. It should just be the two of us. Like, his like sick obsession with her, and how healthy it is for Jamie when he gets kidnapped by the Starks and then roams around with Brienne and has a break from Cersei and like begins to display some humanity.
Yeah, getting his arm cut off really, you know, did well for him.
I mean,
it really agrees with him.
It really does. It looks well on him. Yes.
Yeah. Hand, I should say, not arm. and then the only thing left in this episode, or a couple things, two things left. Firstly, we find out that Dany is pregnant, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought it was interesting that they said, hey, she has not bled for two moons, which I guess means that the moon cycle is the same in Westeros world as it is on Earth.
Right? This is like one of your questions that we're going to get an email about. Sure. Yes.
Okay. I'm not going to go down that path. I did think that Jorah had a freaking big guilty sign hanging around his neck. You know, he's like, she's pregnant. I gotta go tell someone about this.
I gotta go to the spy port where the spies go.
Yeah, I have to write the letters. Cohor, I think, is what he says, right?
Yeah.
And so I just thought that was, like, knowing what we now know about Jorah, I thought that was hilarious because he did nothing to be subtle about that. He didn't even just slip away silently. He's like, I gotta get out of here, and here's where I'm going.
Well, at least he was just in front of, like, you know, the Recaro. It wasn't, like, in front of Dany or anything like that. Recaro, by the way, it's fun to see him here because that actor, Elias Gabel, I don't know if I just butchered his name. But anyway, he's the lead actor on Scorpion, which is a terrible CBS show. But, you know, it's just funny to see his beginnings here. And now he's, like, this leading man on this big CBS show.
That's so awesome. Yeah, and he's effective in this scene too, you know, just talking with Jorah about he's kind of our window into the Dothraki world in this
scene. Yeah, I love that scene where they're talking about armor and swords and right. You know, all that sort of stuff,
or metal dresses.
Yeah, metal dresses. Mm-hmm. Or like the like funny banter when Dany's handmaiden comes in, she's like, get a chicken, get a duck, get something, and he's like, a dog? Or is like, no, not a dog.
Apparently Westeros also has the same social conventions around eating dogs as we do.
You know.
I'm just pointing out ways in which Westeros is similar to us that are curious to me, that's all. So anyway, I can tell you're really enjoying it, Joanna. I can tell you find that topic of exploration fascinating.
Should we talk about the metric system again? That's
No, we shan't. We shan't mention that again.
Okay.
Okay. Look. Let me just say this. It's not going to be about the metric system. But the point that a listener made that I thought was very good is that if you're going to – it makes sense that things would be similar because make them less distracting, right? But I think it is interesting how the show kind of tries to find that balance between – something that's so similar that it feels anachronistic and something that is so foreign that it feels like we don't even understand what it is. So I may point that out because I think it's somewhat interesting how the show approaches that. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Okay, good. And with that, I will not say anything more about it this episode. So the only other thing that happens Dany says she knows it's a boy because apparently she can feel it. And then we have the Cyro Ferrell scene. At the end, right?
You are late, boy. Tomorrow you will be here at midday.
Who are you?
Your dancing master, Cyro Ferrell. Tomorrow you will catch it. Now pick it up. That is not the way, boy. It is not a great sword that is needing two hands to swing it.
It's too heavy.
It is heavy as it needs to be to make you strong. Just so. One hand is all that is needed.
Yeah.
And this is George R. R. Martin at his best. You read this scene in the book, it is almost word for word taken from the book, right?
Yeah.
And even from the book, you get a sense that this person speaks with a different accent. You really get a sense of their personality and how different it is from all the other characters. And that just takes talent, man. You watch it. Look, Aaron Sorkin is brilliant, but a lot of his characters talk exactly the same way, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, you know, when you meet Cyril Farrell, this is a character completely unlike, well, maybe similar to some certain other characters. You know what I mean? Like, he's not really similar to any of the other characters in the show. And I just think the way the dialogue is written is so vivid and so crisp and differentiated from the other characters. That's what I really came away appreciating, beyond the fact that the performance is amazing. Any thoughts on this final scene?
Yeah, I think, I don't want to go like too hyperbolic, but I mean, just the way that
this
actor,
may be the finest scene in the history.
No,
of television.
No, but like maybe no one has ever immediately made a character quite that memorable. I mean, Cyril Farrell, I think only has like three scenes, maybe. I think.
Well, we'll count them.
You know, we'll
I gotta say, I think it's more than that, but. Well, maybe. I guess Baylor happens in episode 9, right?
Yeah.
Okay, and we're already on episode 3. I don't know. Yeah, he probably doesn't have more than one scene per episode.
Right.
So, at most, 6 scenes.
Right. I think it's closer to either 3 or 4, because I don't think we check in with Arya and her water dancing every episode. And he just, like, he's so, you know, what do we say to the god of death? Not today. Like calling her, you know, boy, or like, you know, man is, you know, full of water. And if you pierce him just so, it comes out and he dies. Like, I mean, Cyril Farrell is it's just such a great character. But I mean, the real poignancy of the scene, right, is when the wood swords clacking together turns into the clash of steel as Ned watches. And like, and then we watch with the added poignancy, knowing who Arya becomes,
right?
And you know, Ned is thinking back to his own war experience and maybe of the conflicts to come, but not ever imagining that his daughter is going to turn into a
psychopathic killer.
A psychopath assassin, you know. And I think the last shot has Sirio sort of like stabbing her in the abdomen as she, you know, mock stabbing her in the abdomen.
Right.
And it's disturbing based on what we know of what Arya becomes. So I think, I don't know.
So this scene with Ned watching them and then it's the sword hitting each other, turning to metal clashing. That's a complete invention of the show, right? I don't think it's in the book or anything like that.
Right.
And I don't know.
You don't like it?
I'll just say it's not the show at its most subtle. How about that? It's not the most subtle move the show has made.
I guess.
Okay, you're right. Never mind, Joanna. You clearly disagree.
We can agree to disagree. It's fine. I really like that moment. I mean, I think the not subtle would be like Ned being like, oh, this reminds me of the war. But just like the making it an audio cue.
I never said it was horrible and, you know.
Okay.
Right. And obvious. I'm just saying it wasn't the most subtle. That's all. Anyway, overall, I think this is another winner of an episode, right? Both like it.
This season's so good.
It's really good. It's really good. Now I remember why I fell in love with the show in the first place. All right. Joanna, where can we find more of your work on the internet this week?
You can find me on vanityfair.com or you can follow me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This.
And I would say find me on Twitter at Dave Chensky. That's Dave Chen, SKY. And by my directorial debut, The Primary Instinct at theprimaryinstinct.com. So next week, we are going to watch episode four, Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things. And we are going to read through Sansa Chapter 2. Now, that does not cover everything that happens in Cripples, Bastards, and Broken Things. To do that, you'd need to get through Daenerys Chapter 4. But getting to Daenerys Chapter 4 requires reading 6 additional chapters in addition to Daenerys Chapter 4. So I would say, like, the safest thing to do is let's just read through Sansa Chapter 2.
Which is around page 304 in my book, just FYI.
Okay.
There it is. But yeah, the Daenerys chapter that is like this weird outlier several chapters later that gets folded into this episode. So yeah, if you want to be a completist, you can read up through then. But if you want to just, you know, get to where
you
want to
be a normal human and follow along with this show, then just read through Sansa chapter 2.
And, you know, we're recording like a couple weeks ahead of you guys, as you might have noticed by the fact that we just, you know, read your messages from episode one. But if you do have feedback about the way the reading process could be streamlined or better conveyed to you, please do let us know. I hope you guys are following along. But if we could do that better, let us know.
Yeah. Feel free to email us at acastofkings@gmail.com. That's acastofkings@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you guys next week.